Welcome to Ankh Live On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. Ankh Live On Air is a podcast from Ankh Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Ankh Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, supported by Bristol-Myers Squibb, we had the pleasure of speaking with Rory Shallis, MD, an assistant professor of medicine and hematology at Yale School of Medicine, part of Yale New Haven Health in Connecticut. Shallis sat down with us to share some of the research that has been generated in myelodysplastic syndrome over the past year or so, touching on the evolution of clinical trial endpoints and where the field is headed in terms of therapeutic classes. He also spoke to the investigation of the late-stage erythroid maturation agent luspatercept in this population in the Phase 3 Element MDS and Maxillus trials. In our exclusive interview, Shallis discussed the research basis for the Element MDS trial in MDS, the potential of intervening with luspatercept before patients become red blood cell transfusion dependent, and aspects of the trial to be aware of for patient enrollment. Within the past year, what research in MDS has caught your attention and why?
There's been quite a bit. It shouldn't be too much of a surprise that much of the research has really been focused on what we generally call the higher risk MDS subsets, and largely borrowing, in many cases, AML style of therapy. The classic one these days is venetoclax, which has a nice home in AML. We're all kind of anxiously waiting the results of the randomized phase 3 Verona trial. And then in parallel, the other randomized phase 3 that's still alive, Select MDS, which is the randomized trial looking at placebo versus tamibarotene or agonist in combination with azacitidine, which to date is still the reference standard. A couple other trials in high-risk MDS and low-risk MDS had some movement recently with the relatively recent approval of imetelstat and, of course, the erythroid maturation agents, with the predominant product being luspatercept, which is really expanding its role and how we address, in this case, low-risk MDS.
And what do you think it says about therapeutic development in MDS that HMAs have such a stronghold in the paradigm?
It's a great question. This is a question that has been asked for many, many years. It perhaps comes down to two things, and maybe in conjunction. One, HMAs are still pretty good treatment. They are largely insufficient. Response rates, depending on how you define them, can still be better. Just because most patients are not going to have a meaningful response to these therapies. I think this is also derived from the heterogeneity of the disease. MDS is amongst the most heterogeneous we really treat, a number of molecular lesions, and it's a disease of epigenetics as well, which I think has led to an absence of truly blanket approaches beyond the HMAs. You're seeing more of a transition to, quote, targeted therapies, again, largely borrowing from AML style therapies, whether it's, you know, IDH inhibition is another good example these days. And I think the role, it will increase to some degree. So I think these are the two main reasons, but certainly this is it requires more research.
And then in terms of clinical trials themselves, how would you say that we've seen endpoints evolve, if at all?
I think they have evolved for the better. It's a slow evolution. And I think the evolution has been largely driven by the realization that our current responses, or endpoints for that matter, response-based endpoints, are perhaps antiquated and, again, insufficient, largely derived somewhat from AML-aligned endpoints, with complete remission being the one which has somewhat of an overhaul. And as of last year, there was a good effort to really optimize this and make it more MDS-centric. For MDS, much of what we're trying to do outside of curing it with an allogeneic hematopoietic stem cell transplantation is restoring hematopoiesis. So much of the benefits that we ascribe to patients that are on particular therapies is how well their cytopenias are improving on a particular therapy. So this is where we look to things like hematologic improvement or reduction in transfusion burden. You know, there are certain thresholds above which we say that's meaningful for the patient. In the low risk space, and I'd argue probably also the higher risk space, it's quite important, is a quality of life assessment as well. Are these therapies, even if they're not leading to true responses, are patients still doing better, at least from a symptom standpoint on these therapies. So many of these trials will have, you know, in many cases, two primary endpoints, a co-primary endpoint, or even some key secondary endpoints that are perhaps more patient-centered. But, you know, the responses we have are largely viewed through the lens of the types of therapies we give, with HMA as being the predominant one, and this induces myelosuppression. And we try to get by with, you know, dose reductions or schedule abbreviations in some situations. So the hope is, as we move towards targeted agents that maybe don't come with this myelosuppressive baggage, that the response rates might actually, or responses might be more aligned with, I think, how we're actually doing good for patients.
Turning to the Element MDS trial, which is, of course, evaluating luspatercept, what would you say the rationale is for evaluating that agent in this population, given its current indications?
Luspatercept has a storied past, going back, you know, many, many years. The first, I'd say, enthusiasm, you know, for the use of this product came from the Medalist trial, which was looking at patients with low-risk MDS, who in this case were refractory to ESAs or erythropoiesis-stimulating agents, or patients who were unlikely to respond to such based on a baseline serum endogenous EPO level, and that trial was 200 or greater, the responses were great. This was a placebo-controlled trial, and this realization prompted the COMMANDS trial, which was the phase 3 randomized patients, in this case that were patients who had red blood cell transfusion dependent, but in this case ESA naive, patients one-to-one to get luspatercept or ESA. The primary endpoint was undoubtedly achieved, 60% versus 30% in favor of luspatercept. Primary endpoint in this case was at least 12 weeks transfusion independence across a number of subgroups, important to getting to your question. Most pertinently, RS positive disease, low EPO, low transfusion burden. These latter two, so having a low EPO and a low transfusion burden, prompted, I think, enthusiasm for Element. So what about introducing this effective agent before a patient becomes red blood cell transfusion dependent, which is actually the majority of patients with low risk MDS at diagnosis? This is what Element MDS is attempting to answer. It's a phase 3, another randomized trial looking at luspatercept versus EPO and really reducing the progression to transfusion dependence in ESA naive, non-transfusion dependent patients with low risk MDS. Low risk defined using what we generally call the revised IPSS. This trial excludes low-risk MDS with deletion 5Q. And as you would otherwise expect to randomize a patient to an ESA, you have to have a pretty low baseline EPO level. It's less than 500 in this trial. Stratified by, I believe, three important factors: baseline EPO level, RS status, a key indicator of who is likely to respond to this agent, and then IPSS risk category. This trial does include the intermediate risk revised IPSS patients, about 20% of all low risk MDS. And this primary endpoint is a 16-week red blood cell transfusion dependence up to week, I think just shy of 100, if I recall. So this is the right trial to do. It's an effective therapy, tends to work for patients who have low EPO, low transfusion burden. So you could just pause it. I think there's good confidence that if you use it earlier, it's going to work better and really prevent patients from becoming transfusion dependent, at least that's the theory. And theoretically stolen the time by which they accumulate this significant transfusion burden, which predicts a non-low risk of iron overload, which associates with morbidity. And just taking it maybe 2-3 steps further might actually increase the risk of a stem cell transplant being safe if iron overload is the, you know, one of the main issues that predicts lesser or worse post-transplant outcomes.
And why is 5Q deletion an exclusion criteria?
This is a cytogenetic subset that has a reference standard in lenalidomide, the brand name being Revlimid. This is generally about, let's just say, 10 to 20% of all low-risk MDS, and it's an oral monotherapy, which has an excellent rate of response and a durable response as well. Some side effects, but I would say the risk-benefit calculation is largely favorable. It's amongst the most favorable we see in MDS. So that's a carve-out by design just because there's already a standard in this case.
And then in terms of accrual to this trial, do you anticipate any barriers?
Perhaps. To be on this trial, you can't be transfusion dependent. One of the key eligibility criteria is having, quote, symptomatic anemia, defined in one of four ways, a patient having fatigue, dizziness, weakness, or shortness of breath. So quite subjective, and patients have to have hemoglobin less than 9.5 grams per deciliter. This might be a point that patients might not have reached yet. It might take time to actually accrue in this trial, I would say. And maybe some patients are otherwise willing to accept a little bit of, quote, mild fatigue and maybe not accept the risks of the side effect profile with this product. Who knows how long these patients will actually be on this product. This is largely an indefinite therapy every 3 weeks. The dosing strategy might change depending on how another trial in parallel known as the Maxillus trial moves forward. And we'll see that data hopefully in the near future. So I could see these being maybe barriers for patients not maybe being fully willing to go on trial. But this is where the quality of life data might be a bit more enticing. And if you can demonstrate that patients do better with this agent and you stall the time to becoming transfusion dependent, that accounts for the toxicity profile with this product and might actually lead patients to, overcome this barrier. But it's a mild barrier.
What would you like your colleagues who are not involved in this research to take away from this discussion? And this can also extend to what we talked about with venetoclax and some of the other pending phase 3 trials.
The main point would be that these trials exist. Reach out to us and explore trial options. Trial options that these days are really founded upon excellent science and a growing enthusiasm that this is kind of the golden age for this disease, I would say. But we can't really move the field forward if patients, are not getting on these trials. And this is largely an extension of, providers not knowing these trials exist. Obviously, some regional differences depending on your healthcare system and affiliations and referral kinetics. But I would say get patients on trial, reach out to us.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air, supported by Bristol-Myers Squibb. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On X, follow us at OncLive. On Facebook, like us at OncLive, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.